You know you belong together, little big pod forever. You're talking on air. Nathan has weird hair. From the very first moment I heard you, I never felt such emotion. From talking on air, I said no, you are there. So hold me in your arms and let me go. I wanna stay forever, closer each day. Graham and
we are live, baby.
This is going to be a very interesting episode. You and I, we don't know too much about our guest.
We don't. We have met him
a handful of times.
Yeah, I was trying to figure out how many times we've met him. Not that many at all. And we were saying we really like this person.
Yeah.
I really like. And when we first met him was on a set of a panto. We got on really well with him. And then we kind of kept in contact and we kind of, our paths have crossed a little bit. And we always found him an interesting character. And what better way to find out about this man than on Graham and Nathan's Little Big Podcast?
You were saying, should we do any research for Paul? We just said no.
There's not that much research out there.
Let's just go in raw. Let's try and...
I did go on his Wikipedia page.
Oh, cool. Here's a Wikipedia page.
I thought you'd be disappointed with me. Because you know I like to prepare for stuff. But there's nothing on it.
It's all... And I will be telling him he has done literally nothing. Now, this guy is called Paul Byram. Do you know the name? Does that mean anything to you? Graham and I, we know him from, as he said, when we did a piece on our breakfast show, Fully Charged. We were in a panto. We made a cameo appearance. And he was the villain in the panto. And he was great fun, very likable. And then... we've been on the Elaine show with him a handful of times, and he's just a funny, interesting, deep guy.
Oh, here we
I
go.
Love this! I get excited!
Here we go. Oh, here we go. Oh, my God.
Oh, hello.
Oh, wow. Oh.
Did I just answer by the phone? I have to put on the camera.
No, you don't have to put on the camera. No. We don't have a camera. We just want to hear the dulcet tone of Paul Byram.
But you don't want to look at me, no?
I would like to look at you, but we've done it before where the camera's been on and we can see you, but you can't see us because there's no camera on our computer screens here in Marconi House. So feel free to put on your camera because I know you've been doing a lot of home workouts while the gym has been closed. I've been closely following yourself and your girlfriend doing your home workouts. So if you want to flex those traps, feel free.
I try. I'm battling age, so that's the primary reason of me doing workouts, you know, to just keep off the stomach and pretend to be a young lad for a little bit longer.
Paul, what are you doing right now?
Like, what am I doing
at this moment in time? Not in life, but just actually in this space of time.
I'm sitting at the computer. Is that a trick question?
No. I'm always interested to see what the guests are like. Because
are you in your living room?
I'm not. I'm upstairs in the office room. Very nice.
Because we do ring people at an awkward time. It is like always between 11 and 12 on a Wednesday. So we do appreciate you taking time out of your day to be on Graham and Nathan's Little Big Podcast.
Can we just welcome Paul? First of all, thank you very much for agreeing to be on. Now, we said just before you're on, Paul, that Graham and I, we've met you a handful of times. We think you're a very interesting fellow. Well, you're humorous and you're deep.
Before we always get our guests to introduce themselves, tell us who they are and what they do. So, Paul, over to you.
Yeah, well, so it's an interesting one. Like, so for I would be my title, I suppose, would be a tenor, a classical crossover tenor. But I suppose, although my training and my early career certainly was classical music, it has become more, I suppose, mainstream over the years. A lot of my recordings have become more mainstream songs with a kind of a classical feel, if that makes sense. And then in about 2008 or so, I signed up with a show called Celtic Thunder, and I went over to the States. It was a group of five singers and singing literally all the diddly eye Irish songs with a modern twist. And that took me then over to America for a number of years. Now, on the side of that, I would do a bit of acting and I do a bit of TV work, as you have mentioned. And so, yeah, I do a bit of everything, really. But musical theatre is primarily where I'm at now, you know.
What would you say was the coolest place you ever performed?
I think it would be hard, probably. Like, so it's a hard question, right? Because as a sports fan, I always get a great kick out of singing for the Boston Celtics. I'm asked to do that regularly. So so that's always a great one because the Boston people are lunatics. And so when you go in as an Irish man and stand in the middle of the garden and belt out the national anthem, they go ballistic. Like, they literally go ballistic. So there's, that's a pretty cool thrill. And then as a theater experience, performing in Radio City in New York was pretty cool. But I think what tops it all is probably singing for President Obama in the White House.
Jesus Christ, Paul, we didn't know that.
I know. I mean, I'm surprised you were even able to get a booking with me this morning.
Paul, what was that like performing in front of Barack Obama?
It was pretty cool. Like, I got to be honest with you, it was all very exciting in the lead up because he had just been elected the previous November. So it was March, was Paddy's Day, and we had got word that we were going to be singing probably about 3 weeks beforehand, and we weren't allowed to tell anybody. We weren't allowed to tell family. We weren't allowed to tell anybody. And they did background checks on our families and everything to make sure that we were all safe coming into the building, you know. And so then the show that I was involved in, Celtic Thunder, that was airing on a station over there called PBS, which I'm sure you've heard of, which is a public broadcasting station. It's kind of a wholesome station. They play a lot of arts and they play a lot of kind of documentaries. And even their news would be kind of considered the most neutral of the news stations in the States. And so we had heard that Michelle and the two girls who were kids at the time were big fans of the show. And so we got invited to sing. And then what was an extra thrill was that I got asked to do a solo as well, which was very, very cool. So it was all pretty exciting leading up to it. And being a kind of a fan of American politics and indeed Barack Obama, I was tickled pink, you know. Then when we got in, we were told that we would have to wear the kilts. I was gutted because it's like one fucking time I'm meeting the president and wearing a dress.
Did you wear your boxers underneath or did you go commando?
I kind of felt the boxes were probably appropriate.
I suppose. You know,
and now, I will say, you know, on many occasions in that, I would have performed it without the boxes, like, for example, Radio City. But, in any case, though, all told, afterwards we had a meet and greet with him, and he came up and he was walking the line and he said, "Guys, I'm sorry, I have to wait. Michelle is just dragging her feet a bit. She seems to be the most popular in the room." And she was. I mean, it was funny. She had just she had an aura about her, lads. I mean, I didn't clock it really from television or leading up to it, but in person, she just attracted the room. She was a very impressive figure. So she arrived in and they started talking and he says, "Where did you get those boots?" And I said, "Oh, that comes part of the costume, you know." He goes, they are awful. I wore them, he says, "when I was dating Michelle." And I said, "Yeah, well, I have a pair downstairs for you." He says, no, I've done a lot better in life since then. I don't need them again.
Paul, so, are you nervous talking to Barack Obama or are you, because you're a very confident man. We've met you a few times, but does even the President of America put you off at the time? Is it a relaxing environment or is there Secret Service standing around you? What's the atmosphere like in the White House?
Yeah, I wouldn't call it a relaxing environment. But that being said, I wouldn't say it was, you know, nerve-wracking either, you know, in that you knew you were meeting somebody iconic, you know, and he was at that time. He was a pop culture icon. He was a political icon. Everything about him was exciting. It was exciting more than nerve wracking. He put you at ease very quickly with the way he walks, the way he talks. He's a very cool guy, you know, and you are put at ease. I mean, you know, all the kind of the people that work around him are a little bit more highly strung. And like we were, only the official photographer was allowed to take pictures and stuff. And so there was all of that kind of stuff. But no, I wasn't nervous. No, he was terribly nice. And I kissed Michelle and I didn't realize that wasn't necessarily out.
Take you to do it, Paul.
You are a charming individual. Paul, if Donald Trump asked you to perform in front of him, would you?
That's not fair, especially considering I'm going to probably have a lot of Americans tuning into this. But absolutely no.
Oh, brilliant, Paul.
Staying with this, Paul, because I actually was thinking about this when Nathan said we had you on. Do you find a certain pressure? Because you do have a lot of American fans. I know you go over there for a good few months during the year. Do you feel pressure to say stuff about the politics in America or to not say stuff about the politics in America? Do you find it kind of contrasting the issues?
Yeah, it is very hard for me because I suppose I take great interest in it. I take great interest in politics here too. You know, I mean, I would take great interest and I think people should be. I always kind of get a bit of a kick when people say, oh, I'm not into politics. I'm like, oh, are you not? But you're into kind of getting the bus every day, and you're into cycle lanes, and you're into, you know, the hospital service being good, and you're into, you know, getting lower tax rates, but you're not into politics. You know, I always find that kind of funny. And people should take a responsibility in taking a little of interest in politics, you know. But with the regards to the Americans, I find them, it's become so divided over there with regards to politics that you it's quite detrimental to have an opinion, almost, you know, in my line of work. I often get people going, oh, my God, why don't you just sing? Just like sing. You are paid to sing. I'm like, OK, no. And so, I won't ever shy away from tweeting my opinion about certain serious issues, like obviously the George Floyd issue that kicked off recently. And I try to stay kind of relatively objective, and I try to be considerate of both sides. You know, it is difficult, but for those that fall out with me, maybe because of my beliefs in equality for the gay community, the LGBT community, or for people that get annoyed with me over commenting on the George Floyd issue, if they don't want to buy my music or turn up at my gigs anymore because of those opinions, I'm quite happy for that.
Yeah, fair. It's a great attitude to have. It's good that you're in a position where you can say, well, do you know what, I don't need you. And that's absolutely fine.
I don't know whether I am, Graeme. You know, it would be more beneficial to keep my mouth shut and pretend I'm delighted with everybody. But I'm not, and I'm never going to be that person, you know. If me standing up for what I believe in as a person and I believe in equality for everybody, and I believe in healthcare for all, and I believe in treatment of all colours being the same when it comes to the police. Well, you know, if I'm going to lose out financially because of that, or if I'm going to end up having no career because of that, well, I'm okay with that too. Oh. You know, I'll find something else because we're all in a position nowadays, I think now more than ever before with the social media that we have, the access to social media, to stand up and speak and say what we think. And if it is on the side of good, well, then even more so we should be standing up and speaking louder, you know?
Definitely. Paul, I'm very interested in how the music industry actually works, because you do go to America for a few months, but you also have your own tour with your face on the side of a bus where American tourists come over to Ireland, and then you drive around Ireland showing them the spots, and you sing songs for them as well. Are you an independent? Do you work for yourself? Is there a record label above you? How does it work for you?
Yeah, well, so I've kind of gone through a couple of chapters in that regard.
Yeah.
When I started out, so keep in mind, I released my first album when I was 14. So,
Jesus.
I did my first opera with the RTÉ Concert Orchestra in the concert hall at 12, and then I released an album at 14. And so all of that time I was kind of independent. Then in 05 I released an album called Velvet, and that was like with a big 56-piece orchestra. But again, I did it all on my own. I did it independently. And that was the one that I suppose kind of kicked me into a bit of notoriety in some regards. And then I kind of plowed away with that. Then obviously when I signed with Celtic Thunder, we were signed then to Decca Records. And that was the first kind of eye-opening I had to a major label. And much in all, as Celtic Thunder, I was treated very well by Celtic Thunder and indeed by Decca. You know, you were very much kind of just, you were paid a fee for your recording, And then that was it. You know, you kind of, whatever albums they sold or whatever amount of albums they sold was irrelevant to you, you know. So that was a little bit of an eye-opener. But then you didn't complain because that was the gamble you were taking. And I was looking at it as a longer project, you know, and that get into America, build the brand and all of that and take it from there, build a career for myself. So I was looking at it more, you know, long-term. But that was the first kind of dealings I had with the major labels. We released a number of albums and TV shows with that. And then after I left the show in 2010, I released an album called This Is The Moment. And it was my first kind of number one album over there, which was with a small label called Shanaki Records. And they, although I wasn't independent technically, it was a small independent label, if that makes some sort of sense. Yeah. I don't know if that makes sense. But so I released two albums with them and it was grand. But I think because I found that the industry had changed so much, like in that people aren't really buying CDs anymore. So the whole point of being with a label, you know, primarily was that they would get your CD into shops, right? And so when you take that main factor away, you start going, well, what else are you bringing to the table, you know, as a label? And I think what they did, I suppose, was they got it into wherever they could get it into, they charted it and all of that kind of stuff. It got shortlisted for a Grammy and all that kind of stuff. So it was that element of things they did great for me, but by and large I thought to myself, well, you know, why am I giving away? Every time I wanted to have stock, for example, at the merch stand in my on tour, I have to buy that album off them for $6, $7. So for each copy. And so I was kind of getting, I have got a little frustrated with that. So the next album that I'm releasing, which is hopefully coming out this year, will be back to being independent. Because primarily you are releasing an album for it to go free on Spotify.
Is it expensive to make an album?
Yeah, well, for what I do, it is. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, a lot of the artists that you guys would play on Spin and so forth, you know, they would, a lot of it goes on in a studio, you know, and a lot of it is computerized sounds and so forth. But I've always kind of prided myself in that all the albums I've done have had orchestras on them and live musicians. And so I know it's more expensive, but there's no sound like it. And I think staying true to what I do, it's important to do that. But also I like employing musicians and giving them some piece of the pie, you know, in some shape or form. So it is expensive, Nathan. I mean, like my Velvet album, the first one in 2005, cost about €130,000. Then the This Is The Moment album came in around €70,000.
Paul, that's a lot of money.
Oh, I know for sure it is. Yeah, and the new one coming out will be, well, oh, I suppose it'll be 40,000 anyway, you know. So it is expensive, like for sure. And as I said, it's frustrating now because, you know, when was the last time either of you bought an album, actual CD?
We were having this discussion just a couple of weeks ago. As in, it must be very difficult because the record stores, why, bar for the fact that you might enjoy the sound of vinyl, or that you don't, because you pay your €10 a month for Spotify and that's it. You have access to every single song in the world, well, 99.9% of the songs in the world. It's just there. So do you make much money off Spotify? Are you honest?
Nothing at all. I mean, the two albums that I released with the independent label are on it. Now call me a cute whore if you want, but the albums I own are not available on it. So if you want to hear them, to buy them. The two albums that the label released are on Spotify at the moment. For example, on the last album I released, I had two songs on it. And when you go on, that I wrote, you know, and so when you go on and you look at maybe the amount of times I've been listening to it, you're like, oh, God, this is going to be great. I can't wait for the royalty check. I got a check recently enough and it came to, and no word of a lie, lads, 36 cents.
Oh.
Dollar.
What?
Percent. In a check. Now, either maybe I'm misreading the amount of times the song has been listened to, or just that gives you an idea of.
So how many streams did you get?
Oh, I can't think off the top of my head what it was. But the point I'm making is that it is 0.01% of a cent is what you're getting.
Oh, my God. Like, it costs more to post out the check to you than the check itself. Well,
I didn't even lodge it. Sure, by God, if I went up to the, I went up to Bank of Ireland with my check for 32 cents, you know.
Oh, so, Paul, are you telling us that the money is in gigs?
Oh, it is. Look, there's no question. Even the top artists like, you know, Bieber and whoever you want to mention, they're all releasing albums, not for album sales now. I mean, obviously, you know, they're getting bigger checks than I am. You know, Taylor Swift, she's milking it, you know. But in fairness to her, she's standing up for the likes of myself, you know, and they're taking on the likes of Apple and Spotify. But the main reason most artists are releasing albums nowadays is to energize your fan base, keep them interested, and therefore, when you do announce concerts, they're there for you. I will say on a side note, I am slightly fortunate in that my fan base are a little bit older, you know, so they're still kind of CD, a lot of them are still CD buyers, you know, and enjoy putting a CD on in their car or whatever it might be, or in their house or whatever. So I am fortunate in that regard. And you'll always find that when you're doing meet and greets after the show and stuff, people will come up with an album or a DVD, because they want to get something signed, and there's all of that. And there's a lot of people that still like getting the artwork and stuff. So, but it is primarily to energize your fan base, and that certainly is what this new album for me will be about, you know.
So, Paul, how did you move from performing at the White House to performing at the Helix, where we met you?
Some might say luck, fortune. Others might say, how did it all go wrong? I don't know. Do you know what it was? Joking aside, I love the Helix, but musical theatre, as I said to you, was a big part of my upbringing, and I did a lot of shows, especially in my early 20s, in Ireland, and I did one in London as well. So, like, I definitely enjoy musical theatre, and though I had done a number of years doing the touring and doing the albums and the White House, as you said, I always kind of hoped I would get back eventually to doing musical theatre at some point. And so when I moved home to Ireland, I lived in New York for 5 years, and I moved home, and somebody rang me and said, look, they're looking for a Gaston in Beauty and the Beast at the Helix. And I thought, A, Gaston, legendary role, brilliant, B, I've always wanted to do a panto, just, you know, like a bucket list thing. Just, I wanted to do one, experience it, see what it was like. And see, a lot of my friends now have little kids. And so I thought it would be a great kick for them to be able to come to the show to see me with their kids. So it was all of those kind of factors. And I went out to the Helix and did Gaston. Thoroughly enjoyed it. And it was a great 3 months of work, which, let me tell you, in this day and age in the business, the music business, when you can turn down 3 months work, you're doing very well for yourself. I was delighted to get it.
Yeah,
and then,
we thought you were great.
Yeah, well, I enjoyed it. And then, yeah, needless to say, then they came back then the following year, and I said, yeah, and then came back again this year, and I thought, you know what, it's grand. It's a nice little thing I do on the side. It shows a different side to me. You know, I get to still do America, and I still get to do the traveling and the touring and the recording and stuff. So I haven't given up that, and I get to kind of do the best of both worlds. As you mentioned, the bus tour, Graham, you know, I came up with the idea. Like, the game has changed so much that you have to constantly think of ideas of making money.
And tell us about the bus tour. Where did that idea come from? Where is the inspiration for that? Because I saw you do that and I thought it was fantastic. And do you have to, you obviously will have to pump a lot of your own money into that to set it up initially. It obviously was a risk as well.
Yeah, it was a kind of a joint venture with a guy in Boston from a company called Travel Concepts. He was a travel operator, and I had been working with him on another project, and he was like, you know, I'd said, oh, I'd love to do something like that in Ireland. You know, I'd love to be bringing, because after gigs, people were forever coming up and going, oh my God, I know, I'm so Irish. And they'd be like, oh, are you really? Where are you from? I'm from Cork. Cork is from. I've never actually been. I'm like, okay. And so then the manager, they're like, I want to go back to see my heritage. And I'm like, okay, well, you know, really, I should try and do something here, you know. And so I thought, you know, we'll do a small bus tour where we cap it at 40 people, and see if it sells. And needless to say, as soon as I announced it, it's sold out. And and we've done four or five. So, but not just Americans. I mean, I've got Canadians coming in on it. I've got Australians come up from it, which is the one that really blows my mind. The Australian support is quite strong and cemented, and so yeah, they come from all over, and I do it every year and a half, and I travel around the country for a week with them. There's a tour guide, obviously, on the bus, and he does all the historical and important information. And every now and again, I just come out with some shite. I don't know. I might come to mind. And then
I love watching your Instagram stories when you're on the bus. I love it because they're all just such cute little American old people, and they're loving you, and you're just playing them, and you're singing them songs, and you're joking with them, and you know all their names, and they're loving you. It's so much fun to follow.
Well, you know, and I have got to know them over the years, and as you might say, I'm playing them. I do enjoy. I have great crack with them. Not going to lie, a lot of fun with them. Some of them are lunatics, and the more lunatic they are, the better I get on with them. You know, and there is great banter, and there's the two tour operators come over with me, and the three of us. Oh, geez, we've got so much Guinness in us by the end of the week, like, you know, we literally drink our way through it, and then I do three concerts over the course of the week, for them. And they go to beautiful hotels and great sightseeing. And I get great pride out of showing Ireland as well, you know. Yeah. It's amazing. It's like when you go abroad, like Tato tastes better, you know. Yeah. So when you're home, when you've lived abroad and when you travel abroad, when you come home, you go, Jesus, we have a great little country here, you know. Mm-hmm. And so when I get to show them and bring them around and they see things. One of the things in particular I found interesting was when we brought them up to Belfast and they were, you know, couldn't understand why there was Palestinian flags, you know, along the walls, you know, on the Republican side. And so little things like that, that opens their eyes to stuff, you know, that's a great thing, you know. So yeah, it's great fun. You just think outside the box, lads, you know.
Yeah, I have to say, I do implore all our listeners to start following Paul Byrum. He's a great person on Instagram. Throughout the whole lockdown, I've been loving your relationship with Kathleen.
Catherine,
sorry, you refer to her as the office worker. When she's working, you start like trying to wind her up a bit.
Yeah, well, so like obviously she's got a real job, right? And so we were technically living together, and she was looking after Bradley when I was away on tour in March, and I came back. I literally cut the tour short. I was in Vegas on the 15th of March doing a gig. And it was wild. I mean, I was on Fremont Street and there was bands out playing and people. And in the meantime, I've got Catherine and my mom and my sister. I'm going, you got to get home. Oh, my God, it's the end of the world. And I was like, are you joking? Either the Americans are not reading the situation or the Irish are overreacting. Needless to say, I got home and I realized very quickly that we weren't overreacting. But so, yeah, we were just in lockdown together from then. And so she had all her laptops and stuff. And I was like, mother of God, like, this is crap. So I'm like, so what are we doing now? What are we doing? And she'd be like, I'm still working. Go away. I get a bit of, I wind her up a lot.
You have such a lovely relationship with her. Where did you meet her?
Through CrossFit. I've been doing CrossFit for a number of years, and I got a text off one of the girls up in the gym going, look, we're doing a competition and we've just lost a team member, would you do it? And I thought, oh God, okay, yeah, grand. I love CrossFit, but I'm also pretty crap at it. So I was like, right.
I'm gonna cut you off there, Paul. You are beefy. You are gaining muscle. You are, and I watch your videos. You are very good.
You're
at CrossFit.
In great shape. For anyone that doesn't know what CrossFit is, can you explain to them what it is?
I suppose I can. And for anybody that doesn't know CrossFit, like, shame on you. No, I'm joking. obviously, CrossFit is like it's a high intensity training with functional movements. And so, you know, your deadlifts, your push press, all that kind of bar work is there. And the class fundamentally is an hour long, and it's split up into a strength section, which would be that, you know, any of the movements, push press or deadlifts or bench press or squats or anything like that. And then the last kind of 15-20 minutes of it is a high intensity workout, you know. So that could include, you know, box jumps, kettlebell swings, pull-ups, skipping, rowing, cycling, anything. It could be anything, really. And it's full on, basically, okay, for that hour. So you're in and out in an hour. It is pretty intense. There's But a lot of people get scared of it. It's actually, I didn't give it a shot. It's maybe not for everybody, but aside from anything else, there's a great vibe in the gym when you go in. Everybody chats to you. So no matter what, like Graham could be lifting something heavier than me and I could be lifting something heavier than you. And you know, it really doesn't, nobody really cares. Nobody gives a damn what, you know, you're lifting. When you go into a regular gym, you go down to the weight section and there's like beefy lads just pumping away and you're there with your two 10 kg bells and you're like, what am I doing here? Whereas there's none of that in CrossFit. There's like nobody cares what you're doing. And there's quite a supportive thing. If you're the last one to finish, people wait. They kind of get, there's all the fist pumps and stuff like that. People could roll their eyes or say it's cheesy, whatever. That's fine.
Yeah, why do you think that? Because my girlfriend Claire does it as well and she absolutely loves it. Why do people shit on it so much?
I have a couple of theories on it. I think because the phenomenon of it was pretty quick and pretty intense. And it grew at a rapid rate. I think a lot of regular gyms and other forms of exercise were quite threatened by it, yeah. And did their best to shit on the form, shit on people's techniques, shit on the coaching. There's all of that. And then when anybody gets injured, they're like, oh, yeah, you see, CrossFit, yeah, I told you you were going to do your shoulder in. You're a gobshite. You'll find an awful lot of people get injuries in CrossFit probably by not listening to their coaching. And maybe when the coach says, maybe you don't need to lift that heavy, and he goes, well, I'm still lifting it, and then he pulls his back out and you're like, oh, well, there you go. Or if people just don't stretch and do all the exercise that you should be doing inside, there's reasons for every injury. But you know, when a golfer pulls his back out after driving a ball from the ninth driving range or whatever, nobody goes, oh, golf, you see, I told you, dangerous sport.
Yeah.
Or all the injuries that come out of a regular gym, nobody goes, oh, that's the gym work for you.
So tell us, where did you meet Catherine?
Well, I met her at this competition. So Catherine was new. She was down from Belfast. I had seen her a couple of times around the gym, and I just knew her as the kind of the hot girl from 6:15 with a great arse. But she was very quiet and kind of, you know, that kind of Belfast vibe about her, you know. She could be lovely or she could kill you. It would be one of the
unpredictable.
The Belfast vibe, yeah.
So I, she's just quiet, you know. And so I kind of just didn't really pay much attention, but I kind of just knew that possibly there was no interest there at all. And so then when we did the competition together, I suppose we got to know each other better, and we went out for drinks later that night, and it's always when people have drink on them that they find me better. So I think that's literally what Catherine did. She found me more interesting with a few drinks in her.
So you're permanently intoxicated now in the gaff, keeping Catherine.
Yeah, like she thinks she's drinking coffee every day, Nathan. It's hilarious.
So
we just clicked, and we've been getting on great ever since. And I wasn't, like many things, I wasn't really looking for a relationship at the time, anything but, in fact. And so, it's taken me by surprise, and it's great. And the dog loved her, and I love her, so it's great.
I have to say, I am delighted for you, Paul, because I always felt we had a bit of a connection. You and I both became single at roughly the same time.
That's right.
I remember thinking, oh, like it was a shitty period, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. But sure, it is for anybody that, you know, has been in a long-term relationship and breaks up. I always kind of, it's very hard one to kind of ever give advice on to anybody, because every breakup is so different. Do you know what I mean? And without getting all mushy and stuff, like it is very difficult, and you kind of have to find your own path really through all those kind of things. And for me, there was an element where I literally just one day I woke up and I said, right, that's enough. Enough of the poor fucking Paul. Everybody's sick of it. I'm sick of it. I'm sick of looking at you. I'm sick of being you. So either pop yourself on or figure it out. And so I did. I kind of just shook myself down. And I remember my good pal Killian saying to me one day, and totally unrelated, just saying to me, you know, I find, you know, just positivity comes to people that are positive. you know, positivity wants to hang out with positivity. And I was like, you know what, you're bloody right. And I, even with regards to work, changed my mentality, changed everything. I was like, the more positive I'm going to be, the more willing people are going to want to chat to me, to hang out with me. Sure, if I was a negative Nancy, neither of you guys would have asked me to do a podcast today. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So there is an element where I just kind of thought, you know, enough is enough. And I found that my life has changed dramatically in the last 2 years because I said enough is enough.
So for anyone listening, Paul, who might be actually be going through a breakup right now, struggling a little bit, maybe they had planned a future with this person and now it's not happening anymore, what would you say?
Well, I mean, I say, well, shit one, firstly. That's really, it is, it's awful when it happens because, especially if it's not of your own doing or if not of your own choice, it really is quite awful. And look, there is no pain like the pain of a heartbreak. There really isn't. And it is kind of like the closest you will get to the pain of loss. And all I would say to them is that you're entitled to be upset and be upset and do all of that. But don't do it for too long, you know, and if it is dragging for too long, you know, be sure to talk to somebody. And if it's just friends or family that you're talking to, fine. But then if that's not helping, well, then maybe even consider, you know, going talking to somebody professionally, because wallowing in pain and heartache can lead to all other elements of depression and upset that you don't want to get into. So you're entitled to be upset for a period of time, absolutely. And whether you're a 14-year-old kid who's just broken up with your girlfriend, or whether you're 34 who's broken up with your wife or your fiance or whatever, it's all pain and it's all relevant and it's all to be respected equally, I think. I think, you know, you have to take it, unfortunately, on the chin. You have to accept what card you've been dealt. Be upset, that's allowed for sure, and because you grow from that, I think. And then there has to come a point where you go, right, enough is enough. I need to get on with my life, you know, because life is to be lived for sure. And I know this is possibly deeper than you guys wanted to get.
No, I love this.
Let's get deep, baby.
You know, life is to be lived, you know, and I, like, I'm 41, lads. I don't know when that bloody happened. You know, I still think I'm 26 and having the crack. Like, genuinely, like, I feel like I'm 20, I dress like a bloody 26-year-old. I hang out with 26-year-olds up at the gym. I still think I'm 26. And although I'm 41, it doesn't matter to me because I feel young and I'm having the time of my life and I'm having a good time. And I think, as I said, you realize and you wake up one day and you're like 41. You're like, holy Jesus, you know. So, you know, if you don't make the most of it, you'll wake up at 51 or 61 and realize what was it all about? You know, I had a friend of mine who lost a friend. He was only 41 years of age this year, and he had two young kids, and it came as a great shock to all of us. And, you know, he had been fighting illness for quite some time. And every now and again, I remind myself that, like, no matter what, even if work isn't going as I would like it to be, or if I don't know, financially I'm not as well off as I'd like to be, or whatever it might be, I have to remind myself, well, at least I'm still bloody here and I'm still fighting the fight. And I think that's the most important thing that our generation need to be aware of and be talking about and be conscious of that. Jesus, lads, we're very lucky.
Yeah.
We're healthy. We're up and at it. So if you are brokenhearted, as I said, back to your original question, it's okay to be upset, but don't let it be all encompassing and don't let it dictate your pattern in life, you know?
Well, Paul, because you seem so happy online, it's good to hear that you're actually happy beyond the Instagram as well, that in your personal life everything's going well. And Nathan too. You're both in brand new relationships.
Both happy.
You both went through heartbreak and now you're probably both happier than ever.
Happier than ever. I'd agree, Paul.
Yeah. And come here, just on that. I mean, that's a point you touch on, Graham. You know, Instagram is great, but it can also be, Jesus, it can be the poison chalice as well, you know. Because we're all, I know for myself even, I go on Instagram when I'm in good form or when I have something to talk about or something to chat about or something going on. You don't see me on there and I'm going, oh, Jesus, where am I paying that? Where's the money coming for that? You know, Instagram is, we're all brilliant at seeing people on Instagram. I follow a number of people that are great. I look for James Patrice is my prime example. He's always delighted. I'd love to know what he's eating out in Malahide. He's always delighted with life. And I admire it because I genuinely think he's like that. He's, you know, he's a terribly upbeat, fun guy. But, you know, you've got to wonder. There's days, I'm sure, he's not in the mood for it at all, you know, and doesn't go online, and maybe he doesn't for a couple of hours. Like, don't be suckered in when you're looking at other people. And I found that even myself. I was looking at people's Instagram accounts, especially people in my age group or people in my walk of industry, and going, how are they doing so bloody well? How are they doing so bloody well? And here am I singing panto songs to a group of 12-year-olds on a Sunday morning. You know, I was angry with life that particular day. But you, do you know what I mean? You can get kind of, suckered into Instagram.
But what that person is doing successful doesn't show the bosses raging at them and the deadlines they have to meet, and maybe they're not reaching their targets, where you're your own boss in a sense. So they're probably in turn jealous of you getting to go out there and sing and do what you've always dreamed of doing.
Oh, yeah. Like, and you have to remind yourself of that as well. People are looking at you going, oh, God, I'd love to be doing what Paul's doing. And so you kind of have to just put it all into perspective. I had this chat with even Catherine there recently about it. You know, and you've got just, again, back to our normal thing, positivity, lads. It's all about positivity.
Paul.
Like, even,
if you, sorry to cut across you. If you were to, you know, speak to your 12-year-old self, like when you look back at your career, because I know you're still very much in it, are you happy with how it's turned out?
Oh, yeah. I mean, if I was to turn back to the 12-year-old kid and he wanted to, and he was looking for advice, and I was to say to him, oh, maybe you should do something else, you know, that 12-year-old kid wouldn't have listened. You know, that's important to remember. Like when you do something like what we do, lads, and you're the same, you're performers, it's just a different type of performance. You know, that's in us. It's in our makeup. We're not office workers. You know, we're not. I couldn't imagine Nathan walking into Davey Doctor's.
How like, fucking dare you?
To imagine, like, so. Yeah, we are who we are. It's in our makeup. It's almost a vocation. Am I happy with how the career has gone? Look, it could have been an awful lot better, for sure. It could have also been an awful lot worse. But I'm at this age in my life, and I've paid my bills up until now, and I'm still paying my bills, and I'm doing what I enjoy, and I've got a very loyal and lovely fan base, and I get to do. I've met lots of people through the business and the industry, and yeah, I've been very lucky, you know. But I can all say it. I mean, Jesus, you could ask Tom Hanks, you know, could your career have been better? He'd have gone, yeah, I'd prefer 3 Oscars instead of 1, you know. So there's always that. I don't get bogged down in that stuff anymore, Nathan. Do you know what I mean? I think it comes with age. You feck it. It's grand. But if I, once I have my bills paid, few bob in my pocket to watch Liverpool on a Wednesday night.
Do you want to talk about it?
Oh, Paul.
Jesus.
Paul. We were going to get to it eventually.
Yeah.
How do you feel? Because you've lived through more of the pain. You obviously saw Liverpool winning titles in the 80s, and then it just stopped. It just stopped. I never got to witness it, so I didn't really know what I was missing. But wow.
Yeah, it's funny, like, because my nephew is 16, Jesus, he's 16. And when he was born, I put him in a Liverpool kit and sent a picture to his father, who was at work, and his father being an Everton fan.
It
wasn't altogether too delighted. But Jack is stuck with Liverpool throughout, and we have our thing every June. We have our boys' day out on his birthday. The two of us traipse into town every year, and even still, which is great because he's now cool and he's, you know, well, what are you talking about? Will you stop looking at me? You know, he's kind of a cool 16-year-old, but he still looks forward to the boys' day out. We go in, we get our new jersey every June together. I buy him his jersey, and we go for lunch and we go to the movies or whatever, and we have a bit of crack for the day. It's our little thing. But I started supporting Liverpool at the age of 1986. So I went to Liverpool for the first time when I was 12. But 1986 I started, and they were winning and they were doing great. But I didn't pay much attention really, because it just, that was the norm, you know. And then, as you said, it just stopped. And I think Hillsborough in particular was a turning point. It was almost a moment in Liverpool's history where it just went dark, you know. And and it has been dark. It was dark for a number of years, you know, and we've gone so close over the years. She's agonizingly close, and it's amazing how deep you get into it. I think because of the fact that during all the way through school, I was surrounded by United fans, and because I was surrounded by them having the time of their lives, winning left, right, I hated them even more and loved Liverpool even more, you know. It's been one of the most consistent loves that I've had all my life. And there, when they won, whatever it was, a week or so ago, got home and I got into bed, and I kind of welled up. I'm not going to lie, lads. It was like this just long journey, and it was finally the monkey was off our back. And I posted a video, a little animation on my Instagram. I don't know whether you saw it. I'm sure you did, because it was everywhere.
Oh, stop. The cartoon of the father and the father and son, then he brings his daughter.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
stop. Yeah. So, did you see it, Nathan?
Didn't see it.
So, basically, it was this dad bringing his son to the game after they won the last league title. And then it showed them walking through the years, and the kid's jersey
getting older.
The kid's jersey would change every single year. The father would get older, and the kid would grow up into a man. And then the father would pass away, and the guy would take his scarf, but then put it on his daughter. And then they would walk, and the daughter would get older and older, and then they won the league. But she'd be holding the grandfather's scarf. And I was like,
oh my God, that's so funny.
God, that hit home. I was like, oh my God.
Look, I will say, as a United fan, much deserved winners, Liverpool. They did deserve to win. And they're a very likable team, Liverpool.
They are. Klopp is terribly nice. Like, he's got a terribly nice way about him, and it must really stick in the craw. Like, because the one thing, you know, about United was Ferguson wasn't particularly nice.
No.
So, and it was great when they were losing. To hate them was easy, because he was kind of quite hard. And then I had the pleasure of singing for Alex Ferguson in Manchester then a couple of years.
What was that like?
Yeah, so funny. So I was asked to sing, and I did, and went over and sang, and that was fine. And afterwards then he asked to meet. So I went up and I was chatting away, and he was talking about Dublin and restaurants and the places he went to, and I thought, oh, shit, he's nice. So I was really disappointed, because I was hoping he would be an asshole.
What was the venue, Paul?
Sorry?
What was the venue?
It was I think it was called the Hilton in Manchester. It was a hotel fundraiser. He has a fundraiser every year for Irish people in Manchester that have fallen on hard times, kind of thing. And he's involved in that. His wife was from the north, as I'm sure you know. And the story or the legend goes that he was playing for Rangers. Now, I stand to be corrected on this. I'm sure some of your listeners will pick me up on this, but the story goes anyway that whether it was at Rangers or wherever it was, she's a Catholic and he's a Protestant, and it was suggested to him that for the best of his career he'd be better off maybe finding another girlfriend, and he left the club on that basis and stuck with his wife, and they've been together since. He was an awful lot nicer a man than I was kind of hoping he'd be. I was kind of, if he'd have been a prick, would have been great. You know, I could have gone, yeah, typical United. And I was playing fantasy football, and I said, just a quick question before you go. I said, it was a Friday night, and United were playing Bolton the next day. And I said, Rio Ferdinand is a doubt tomorrow to play. He says, no, drop and put in John O'Shea.
Oh, that is amazing.
Did you tell him you were a Liverpool fan?
Oh, I did. Yeah, I did indeed. But, he was pretty cool. But, no, football has been a huge part of my life. I love, love, love football. There's a couple of things in life I love very much. And football is, Liverpool is number one on it. And then my dog. They're neck and neck, you know. It's a great old thing for
us. I was trying to describe my love for Liverpool to Claire, because I don't think, she understands it now, but I think she found it very hard to fathom. But you use the line that I think I use, or something similar, that it's the one constant that's been through your life. Since I was born, my dad put a Liverpool jersey on me. Until I die, I will always have a Liverpool jersey. So it's the one constant. Since you were born, it will follow you through hard times. When Klopp is managing, or when feckin' Roy Hodgson is managing, when we're in the relegation zone, it is the one constant. And I think, since we've been through such hard times, we'll stick with it anyway, however bad it gets. So we fucking deserve this, Paul.
We do deserve it. And I find it lovely and magnanimous of you, Nathan, to say, oh, we deserve it. We don't need you to give us that.
Fuck you, Paul. I'm trying to be nice here.
You needn't bother being nice. We can see through it. And we're 23 points
Paul,
ahead.
All I'm saying is Ollie's at the wheel. Next season's a different story.
Ollie's at the wheel, I tell you what. I would rather get in the car with a drunk driver, you know.
Paul, you mentioned someone that we are very fond of a few minutes ago as well. His name is Killian O'Sullivan. You're very good friends now, but I reckon back in the day, you two boys were boys about town.
Wild.
I've heard stories about is it Lily's?
What was Lily's off Grafton Street like?
Yeah, its heyday during the Celtic Tiger, you two used to go there. I want to know what it was like.
That was like the Coppers, wasn't it? Or the Crystal.
Crystal, wasn't it?
Dear God, Nathan, the Coppers. Please, how very dare you. So Killian and myself, a couple of funny stories if you have the time.
I've
pulled up my seat.
Killian and myself started, we met doing a TV show, which might be beyond your memory, a show called Jigs and Reels. It was a reality show where so-called celebrities, which is kind of slightly cringy saying when I'm involved, but celebrities were paired up with professional dancers from Riverdance.
Okay.
Every week, much like Dancing with the Stars, we would go out and dance to a modern song, but Irish dancing.
So this is a great concept. This is unbelievable.
Yeah, it was Bill Hughes' production, and Killian was on it, Michael Crute was on it, myself, Dana. There was a whole host of people.
I want to say Killian was massive at the time as well, because he was on Fair City. What was his character? What was his character's name?
He was Lorcan on Fair City.
Yeah.
And he, as I often say, had the Fair City vote going in. So there was very little chance for any of us, really. But
it's all politics.
Of course. And so, anyways, week by week went by, and sure, every Sunday went out on air, and it was huge viewership at the time. And anyways, myself and Killian and Dan, I got to the final. But sure, at this stage, myself and himself have become great old pals. And I didn't win. Killian won. But that's neither here nor there.
Nah,
and the fact that then we used to just go out to all these different events. The opening of an envelope would be at it, you know, just a pair of us, two bios about town, as you said yourself. And he had highlights, I had highlights, we were deadly. And and then one night, this is a funny story. So one night I'm out on the jar with him, and we were in the Cafe en Seine on Dawson Street, and we got talking to a couple of the script writers from Fair City, and one of them turns around and goes, oh, do you know, you'd be brilliant in Fair City. I said, yeah, I know I would be. Like, I was, you know, keep in mind, I'm geeked. And so she goes, would you come in? We're right, there's a new part for the chef in the bistro, and we think you'd be brilliant. I said, oh, yeah. And so that was grand. Then the next day, I get a phone call from RTE. And I was like, oh, Jesus. And I keep in mind, I was hungover. I didn't really remember what was going on. And it's, Paul, will you come down for your screen test at 4? Now, I was kind of joking, and I said, I was trying to backtrack, and I was like, all of my training is in stage acting. I have no on-screen acting. I'm trying to talk myself out of this, you know? And anyways, I said, look, sure, come on down anyway. And there's a couple of other people being seen for the part, so it's neither here nor there. You'll be grand. So I went down, did the screen test, and Jesus.
How was it?
Within an hour of the screen test, I got offered the part.
How good of a chef were you?
I don't know. Like, I just read the script. I wasn't looking for a role in Fair City. And anyways, then I was like, well, sure, I have it now. I may as well do it.
So were you in Fair City?
I was in Fair City then for a couple of months. And then they wanted me to stay on, and they were developing the character. But at the time, I was being seen for the part of Dean Martin in the Rat Pack in London, and I got down to the last role on that. So I had to make a call on whether I would do the, you know, go over and do the audition. So I went in and I said, look, I've got this audition. Can I go over for it? The producer was like, look, you're going to have to decide whether you want to be in the show because we're developing you or whether you want to be a singer. And so when it was said to me like that, I was kind of like, oh, no, hold on. Singing is always going to be number one. So so I left the show. But I was only in it for a few months. But, yeah, that was as a result of being out on the town with Killian O'Sullivan. So just be careful, lads. You've been warned.
Paul, could the chef...
I want a gig could, in Fair City.
Yeah, Paul, could the chef ever return like Dirty Den in EastEnders?
Yeah, well, now that I'm a little older and further down the road, I would love to go back to Fair City. It would be great crack. And it was great crack. They were all so lovely as well.
Was there much money in Fair City, Paul? Not to be crass, but at the time, were you happy with it?
Oh, for sure I was. Yeah. Listen, I do nothing for the good of my health. You know, wait till you see the invoice that's coming for this.
The roles you're going to get after this podcast, it'll pay for itself.
Oh, sure. Look, I mean, if I get a few baseball caps like yourself, Nathan, Graham, should I say? Sorry, the caps is very funny. I watch you on Instagram. The pairs on Instagram are quite funny. I just blown away with some of the caps you look great in, and then other caps.
How dare you?
Well, And then there's the GAA shorts. Can we discuss that for a moment? I mean, there's been a lot of talk about me for the last kind of 53 minutes
or
whatever.
Get at him, Paul. Come on.
What do you have?
Throw a few digs.
Can we talk about this as a general kind of thing? So, like Paul Mescal, right? He's come on the scene there now and blown us all away with his nudity and his big tackle. His chain and his shorts, right?
Yeah.
The chain and shorts thing, I thought, were always hideous. And now, all of a sudden, because like, you see, I don't know about you lads, but the gym, some of the lads turn up at our place wearing GAA shorts to do CrossFit, and GAA shorts maybe in a regular gym, and you're like, or GAA shorts on your holidays. And you're like, lads, there's only one place for GAA shorts. And I love the GAA, don't get me wrong. There's only one place for them. That's the pitch. Do you know what I mean?
Are you saying
is that a brand new nightclub?
Are you saying that I'm copying Paul Mescal? Because I had this, again, bringing up Claire. She said one day when I walked in with the GA shorts, she goes, oh, here he is, Paul Mescal. I go, don't you dare. I've been wearing these GA shorts long before normal people came out because, Paul, frankly, I've got fantastic legs.
He does.
And the short shorts enhances my thick thighs. So yeah. I will continue to wear them, Paul. And look, if there's a hint of jealousy from you coming from your CrossFit where you're doing your exercises wrong, maybe you need to work more on your legs.
I feel there's some movements in CrossFit that aren't maybe accommodating to GAA shorts, where you might see the religion of the participants.
I'll be fine with that. Don't worry. That doesn't affect me.
I feel just that you were seeing a lot more of the shorts on your Instagram as of late, coincidentally. I mean, I'm not saying that you didn't always wear them.
Keep your eyes out of the tackle, will you?
Yeah.
Eyes up.
You pervert.
Eyes on the cap, not on the shorts.
And when we're at it, these are other things that I have to get off my chest. Whilst we're at it, those Crocs are an atrocity.
Shot, big man over here. Of course you're saying this behind Skype, not to my face.
I will say it to you, absolutely.
You get a headbutt.
I bought that sunglasses thing that you were doing.
You bought the G-string. We were doing did you? Off the show.
You bought the G-string.
I contributed to that, yeah.
Very quickly, what was that? Just explain.
Sunglasses, chain to go around your sunglasses. It was the must-have fashion accessory of summer 2019. And we raised money for Crumlin Children's Hospital.
Yeah, and I got one of them because I was so appalled by the Crocs. Not even so much for Crumlin. I mean, I just don't... I can't understand...
because you have horrible feet, Paul.
Are they comfortable, though?
They are extremely comfortable. See, I have lovely feet, so I want to showcase it. Ugh. And you can with the small holes on the Crocs. With your grubby CrossFit feet, you need to cover them. Put them in a bucket of acid.
I think feet in general should just be covered. Let's be very clear on that.
Before you go, Paul, I want you to plug your new album.
Well, I suppose there's very little for me to plug right now, but what I will say to you is that the album has been made. We're kind of in a tricky crossroads because I'm hoping to do it with the RT Concert Orchestra, but we don't know if they're sitting yet. We're trying to get dates on that. Because of, obviously, COVID, you can't have a whole orchestra sitting in a studio. So there's lots of things like that that need to be worked. There's an orchestra in Prague that are willing to do it, but ideally my first port of call would be to hope to do it with an Irish orchestra. So the hope is that it'll be out this October, and it'll be musical theater kind of crossover stuff, a couple of mainstream songs with a classical feel, my kind of touch to them, I suppose, and that's going to be out in October. But look, I suppose just follow me on Instagram and you'll kind of get an idea as to what I'm up to if anybody's of interest. I must say I'm very touched that you've asked me to be on this, because you guys are cool cats, you know.
We're absolute losers,
no,
Paul.
We are the losers of the industry.
But I do want to say, Paul, we've always found you so interesting. You're a lovely man. You were always very kind to myself and Graham.
Especially when we were in the panto for one night only, twice. And we were shitting ourselves as we were about to go on stage in front of a load of kids.
And he was so accommodating.
You were so nice to us. You made us feel right at ease.
I will say the coverage he has got on the back of the Matt Damon thing as well was brilliant. I'm so delighted with the pair he is. The interview happened, but B, that she's got the coverage. It's great to see young lads like yourself thinking outside the box, going for it, putting yourselves out there. And you know what, you've obviously been supported by the station, which is great, but even with just the podcast and everything, you're out there doing it. There's a lot of people talk about doing these things and you guys are doing it, and there's a lot to be learned from that, so fair play to you boys.
Paul will have to come on again. He's been a lovely guest. We've loved it.
Ask Paul by rum, with by rum with an M,
spell it out, will you?
PaulByrom on Instagram, and congratulations on your blue tick.
Oh yeah,
blue tick.
Life is good. Life is good. I got the blue tick. Why?
Because someone was imitating you, weren't they?
Yeah, I got some fella.
Sorry about that.
Yeah, but if you're going to imitate me, make sure you spell the surname right. But he was then adding a whole load of my friends and family and stuff, and a couple of then people from the States contacting me going, oh, is this you and whatever. I was like, oh no, this is a disaster. I obviously never had that to deal with in the past. But yeah, some guy was imitating me, and so I reported it to Instagram, and thanks be to God, they rectified it, and we're all good. So now, if you don't see the blue tick, it's not me.
Do you want to imitate myself and Nathan, and maybe we'll get blue ticks?
Yeah, I'll set up one about you guys.
Before we go, Paul, can you sing us out, like maybe 12 seconds of a song, and then we'll just lower the fader and say goodbye?
You know what? You give people an inch and they want a mile, you know?
Paul, like, please!
What kind of budget? Wow, wow, wa-da-la-la!
Yes, Paul! Paul, thank you so much for joining us on Graham and Nathan's Little Big Podcast. We really appreciate
what a man.
You taking your time. An hour! An hour! We did an hour!
So generous.
Always, boys. Take
best
care.
Of luck, and hopefully we'll see you very soon, Paul. Bye!
Bye-bye-bye.
Look after yourself, Paul. Bye!
Oh, well, that was just beautiful.
That's just good for the soul. Paul is so nice.
That was thoroughly enjoyable. Thank you very much for tuning in. We hope that you enjoyed our conversation with Paul as much as we enjoyed it here in the studio. I think we got through quite a lot there. And we will chat to you next week. Thank you. Goodbye.
Cut my life into pieces. This is my last resort. Suffocation.